ago, I sat down with our friend Ryan Ray to talk about colonial Florida and how it impacts Florida today. So this podcast was so fantastic. We're subbing a weekly Florida history podcast for it. This is probably a more comprehensive look at the history of Florida or the colonial history of Florida than anything we've done in an individual Florida history podcast, and ties it to the present day better than probably anything we've done. So thanks to Ryan. This was episode 6 of his podcast, Tropical Depression, which is now this week's episode of the Florida History Podcast.
Florida does have an awful history when it comes to race. I mean, one of the reasons Florida became a territory is the United States wanted to expand and protect the franchise of slavery from Georgia plantation owners who were having their slaves run away with Seminole Indians. So the United States invaded the territory of Florida and waged a war of genocide against the Seminole Indians. That's something that's not really taught that clearly in schools. So you had asked earlier, why is this happening? Well, there is a fuller account, a racial reckoning and a historical reckoning of our past in this state and this nation, which is coming to the fore and is producing a lot of tension from people who don't want to hear those facts.
That was veteran Florida reporter Mark Caputo on Florida's early history as an American territory. New state laws and Board of Education policies now direct instructors to downplay the horrors of slavery and the role of institutional racism in Florida's basic social makeup. Understanding our history matters more than ever when it comes to understanding what critics call a battle against the new historical dark age with hard-right zealots in the governor's orbit. That's why we're talking with author Kartik Krishnayar this week about his new book on colonial Florida under British rule and about how history works in the free state of Florida. We at the show believe pursuing the real meaning of Florida is a requisite part of getting back on track towards progress. With an ongoing war against honest Florida history programming, along with the general decline of newspapers and historical research, our self-understanding risks erosion, like the coral reef being bleached by rising ocean temperatures. Just weeks after securing re-election last November, Governor DeSantis wrote in his autobiography he identifies culturally more with Western Pennsylvania or Northeast Ohio than with his own native Pinellas County. Florida's reputation as a placeless place, largely unrooted in its own ambiguous history, has only grown in turn. Tourism boosters, real estate speculators, and politicians have long been known to manipulate the record and ignore unpleasant facts of Florida history. But under this governor, ignorance has essentially become official policy within our colleges and universities, with nearly every organ of the state facing issues with weaponized political ideology hanging over them. What kind of place is Florida really? Where did today's Florida, a lonesome American state that has been ruled under 5 national flags, come from? The British considered Florida a territory more similar to Caribbean holdings like the Dominican Republic than to other American colonies like Georgia. While Miami is often considered the capital of Latin America, Florida's internal politics become ever more national. We discuss all of this and much more with our guest, Kartik Krishnayar, a wealth of knowledge and a true Florida expert. We thank him for coming on, and thank you for listening to episode 6 of Tropical Depression, coming to you this week from Mexico Beach. If you're in Tallahassee, do yourself a favor and check out the Knox Market Deli on John Knox Road, open for breakfast or lunch Monday through Friday at 9 to 2. Mention this ad for 20% off any sandwich. 325 John Knox Road in the Woodcrest Office Park, Building F. Thanks for listening.
All right. Well, we've spoken many times before, Kartik. Kartik Krishnayar, publisher of the Florida Squeeze, historian of Florida, longtime Democratic politico and activist. Introduce yourself a little bit to those who may not know your work, and a little bit about yourself, Kartik.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Ryan. And love what you're doing with Tropical Depression. Your first few shows have knocked it out of the park. So I'm going to have a really tough acts, several tough acts to follow.
No, thank you.
Yeah, so I'm a longtime Democratic activist slash operative. I mean, I couldn't ever kind of embraced completely the professional side of being an operative. And I couldn't, the activist side, I could never divorce from being this sort of cold-hearted, neutral type of a political operative that you see so many of on Adams Street and around Tallahassee. So I would say I was kind of an activist consultant, worked for the state party, worked for multiple local parties, worked for multiple candidates over the course of the last 25 years. In recent years, I've always been a history buff, but in recent years, I've really gotten into Florida history. And we're going to get into this, I'm sure, in the conversation, but it is the malfeasance in how this state has been run by Republicans, many of them recent transplants to the state, that has gotten me into this mode of really embracing and talking about and writing about Florida history in a way that I didn't, let's say, a decade or two ago.
Jump into the subject of your new book, which, by the way, congratulations on its publication.
Thank
Florida
you.
And the British. And Florida colonial history prior to the American Revolution is the subject of your book. And I think early Florida history is so underlooked in general. Tell us a little bit about what drove you to intervene specifically about this part of our history, and then we'll jump into the content of your book.
Yeah, it's a perfect segue, what you just said, Ryan, because it was the lack of institutional memory, the frustration I had, even with some of my fellow Democrats, not knowing what the Graham years were like and the Askew years were like and how the state was governed and the programs and the progressive changes we made in this state, that drove me to look kind of deeper at the lack of institutional or historical knowledge. And then I realized that the narrative about Florida history is all wrong. We pick up the narrative when Florida becomes a part of the United States in the 1820s, and it develops just like any other southern U.S. state at that point, from that point forward. And that's absolutely the case until Leroy Collins is the governor. It is a from 1821 until 1952. Till the election of Dan McCarty in 1952, Florida is just like any other southern state. In fact, it might be worse than other southern states. Mm-hmm. But
you're talking about in terms of its rural agrarian sort of pattern of development, right?
Yeah, economic development, the cultural attitudes in terms of its lack of progressive governance, and quite frankly, it's corrupt governance and the pork chop gang, et cetera. I think the key event was the 1952 election of Dan McCarty that began to change the state. But prior to that, Florida, just like any other southern state. But when you go into the period before the United States, before Florida became part of the United States, you find a pattern of development and culture that is completely different than the colonies immediately to the north of us, than Georgia, the Carolinas, or Virginia, or Maryland, which was actually a southern state up until, I would say, up until the early 1900s, was like any other southern state, even though they did not secede. Those of us who know the Civil War history well realize that there was overwhelming Confederate sentiment in Maryland, and they didn't secede largely because of Lincoln and the federal government's intervention. But Florida, completely different. And we have a governor right now, quite frankly, and you can't escape this issue. We could talk about history, and there are people who write about history who say, oh, I'm just a historian. I'm just writing about history and divorcing it from contemporary politics or contemporary events. You can't do that, in my opinion. And the reason I wrote this book is, quite frankly, because of Governor DeSantis, because he keeps giving a very sanitized narrative about American history. And it's an American history that, despite the fact that he's a Florida native, cuts Florida out of the narrative completely, because the experience of Florida developing in colonial times is very different to the, I would say, idyllic, from his perspective, the idyllic view of colonial America that Ron DeSantis and his acolytes have.
As opposed to being something aside, right? You and I have both known that there's something profoundly, quintessentially American about Florida. And I think some of the patterns that we're seeing in terms of history and how history is treated, here we are again, right? The bleeding edge, the tip of the spear, of American history and American contemporary culture. Well, so thanks for taking a look at this. And it's really cool to talk about this with you, especially at this time in Florida's history, unprecedented time of national significance in Florida's internal politics. Talk to us a little bit, situate us in time. Tell us what point of view you wanted to advance with this book, and help situate us in history about where Florida is in terms of its brief British period and how it was seen during their longer period of Spanish colonial rule.
Yeah, so the reason I took the perspective of the British in writing this this book is because I wanted to set up the second volume, which will be about the American Revolution, which is where the real distance between what Florida experienced and what I'm talking about and what Governor DeSantis says on a regular basis, which is informed by his, I guess it's elite Ivy League education, where Massachusetts and Connecticut are at the center of the world. And you've got Federalist Society types forcing down this idea of constitutional originalism. But
and as it happens, this is somewhat... it boggled my mind, but I guess you know we've seen this before. We're seeing the sort of Midwestern intra-American identity politics from this governor, who in his memoir, weeks after getting re-elected governor of Florida, he talks about how he feels spiritually, ancestrally, his sort of cultural roots are in Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Yeah, so this is the same guy who says he gave us state pride, which is complete bunk. I love the way Congressman David Jolly, a former Republican colleague of Ron DeSantis in
right,
the U.S. House, went after him. Sim, yeah, said, look, Florida pride has always been a thing for generations. I'm a sixth-generation Floridian. If anything, I think Jolly made the point, our pride has been diminished by you. But this is a guy who has been eager to point out how he is not like a typical Floridian. I think he's rejected, to a large extent, his Pinellas County roots. He's a guy, not to get too deep in the weeds here, but if you drive around his former congressional district right now, you'll see all kinds of Trump signs. You see very few DeSantis signs. He is a guy that has used Florida without actually appreciating what made Florida unique and different. And that
the DeSantis phenomenon, yeah, seems to sort of glide across the surface of Florida without really partaking of its substance.
And it used to be a source of pride, even the unconquered mentality that the Seminole tribe was the one tribe that was not conquered. Second Seminole War is a subject that First and Second Seminole War we're eventually going to get into in my future volumes in this series. It's something, and quite frankly, I mean, this isn't something I'm necessarily proud of, but the fact that Tallahassee was the one capital east of the Mississippi that the Union didn't capture, right? The Battle of Natural Bridge ensured that Tallahassee remained in Confederate hands until the final surrender.
And I think we see some cultural play from modern conservatives, right? You see about yeah. that. They kind of are coy. There's some coy references. I think even some of the FSU iconography about being unconquered kind of, you know, it relates to the Seminole history as it relates to the federal American government. But it also is a sort of a dog whistle, isn't it, to some Confederate true believers out there.
That's why DeSantis has adopted the Governor Mosley flag, let us alone, which is a plea to stop the federal government from interfering in slavery in Florida. Now, it's also very ironic because DeSantis is a Republican and the Republican Party was originally founded as an anti-slavery party. Let's face it. That is the origin of the Republican Party. Whether it was people who were flat-out abolitionists or it was more pragmatic Republicans like Seward and Lincoln who said, we won't mess with slavery in the South, but don't you dare try and expand it outside the South. It was an anti-slavery party. And you see DeSantis, like so many other Republicans from the South in recent years, kind of holding on to that that pro-slavery Democratic image of the 1840s and 1850s. But the thing that I wanted to stress in writing this book and the subsequent books that are to come in this series is that Florida developed differently. Florida was different. And in fact, it's something we can be very proud of. It was a much more cosmopolitan and vibrant place than it's given credit for.
Well, thanks a lot for looking into that history. I think you're so right. In some opportunist haste to remake Florida in their own image, I think a lot of what's interesting and singular about Florida, and that is one thing you can say about it, It is a place that's not really like any other place in the Western world. It's kind of a Caribbean area, really. It's kind of people have called Miami or Florida the capital of Latin America in many ways. It's a trans-regional, trans-hemispheric, international place here. And at the same time, it is home to some of the petri dish early experiments of kind of white bread, more homogenous right-wing Republican politics here in nature. It's this very interesting place that's given rise to all sorts of things. And I'm glad that you're looking into it. And I can't wait to look at this book and future works with you. Tell us about Queen Anne's War and how Florida's prestige and imprimatur was changed around that colonial war.
Yeah, and before we get to Queen Anne's War, your point is really well taken, because the British, as they're governing Florida, don't know whether Florida should be like Georgia and the Carolinas, or should it be like the West Indies. They were of two minds. They saw it as very much kind of an in-between place. And eventually, they came to the conclusion Florida was more like the West Indies. Let's develop it in a similar fashion, which also explains some of the things that happened during the American Revolution. But back to Queen Anne's
Absolutely.
War. Absolutely. You're in Tallahassee. Obviously, you've been to the mission, and that is an unbelievable reconstruction. And give the people so much credit, because I was alive when that place got redone and when that history began to be explored and honored. And so, Queen Anne's War destroyed that mission and so much else of what was vibrant about 17th century Spanish Florida. So Queen Anne's War begins in 1702. The first battle...
For those who be total novices, is Mission St. Louis.
Yeah, yes. And there was also a mission in St. Mark's that got destroyed in that war as well, a little to the south
Spanish
of...
Spanish missions in early colonial Florida.
Tallahassee, yeah. Yes. Or the Appalachian region, as it was known then. So you had the Appalachian native tribe in that area, and the Spanish had set up missions like they would later do in Texas and California. The missions in Florida were first. I guess missions in New Mexico maybe came earlier, places like Santa Fe. El Camino Real Road had been built from St. Augustine as far as what is now Tallahassee by 1640 and even further into the hinterland after that. And you had along that road various villages and Spanish missions that were largely populated by natives. And they were natives that were being actively encouraged to convert to Catholicism. And that's a constant theme. As much as we can say the Spanish maybe were more enlightened than the colonists to the north, they were still very much, their zeal was religious conversion. Maybe they didn't have the same concept of race that the northern European settlers had, but they were religious zealots. So they're trying to convert the natives, pacify the natives by converting them to Catholicism. But these missions were vibrant, and the economy of Florida was very strong. In fact, you could argue, as Queen Anne's War begins in 1702, St. Augustine is a more cosmopolitan, multicultural, and more diverse economic place than any other spot in what is now currently the United States, more so than Boston or New York, which had been New Amsterdam, obviously, and Philadelphia.
Super interesting.
At that moment. Yeah.
Really interesting and understudied, I think, history here. We had from the earliest times in European colonial development in America, Florida has been at the forefront.
Yeah. And so, long story short about that war, the English invade Florida. This conflict really has its origins in the founding of Charleston, which was in the 1670s, and then the Spanish deciding, in order to destabilize the Carolina colony, as it was then known, this is before North Carolina was formed. So when we're talking about Carolina, we're talking about South Carolina.
And Florida, to destabilize that colony, was known as, but Florida was often known by as the Floridas.
Yeah, yes, right, which we'll get into a little later in the conversation. So in order to destabilize the English colonies to the north, and they become British colonies after the Act of Union in 1707, when Scotland and England become one crown, not that the Scots are happy about that even to this day, but 1707, big date. But prior to that, we're talking about English colonies, and the Spanish crown began sanctioning the encouragement of runaway slaves.
let's destabilize the colonies to the north of us, which are wholly dependent on slavery, by encouraging slaves to run away to Florida. They have to, if they want to be free in Florida, they need to convert to Catholicism, which most were willing to do. And they have to give us some sort of service. So this isn't in full effect during Queen Anne's War, but the English and then the British see the threat. The governor of Carolina, James Moore, burns down the Appalachian province, the entire province, the area around Tallahassee, what is now Tallahassee, hauls back lots of natives as and they become slaves in the Carolinas. They seize St. Augustine, and St. Augustine survives because the Castillo, which has just been built, Castillo de San Marcos, holds because of the Coquina Rock, which is something I think we all, those of us who know Florida, know that that rock absorbs a cannonball rather than break it. So St. Augustine holds. Pensacola, they try and capture. They're unsuccessful. The French later capture Pensacola and give it back to the Spanish. But there was a period of about 5 years, 5 or 6 years, where the French occupied Pensacola. But the English don't capture it at this point, which is the important thing. But Florida becomes depopulated. This is the key. Queen Anne's War was a devastating thing for Florida. And the economy of Florida really doesn't recover, you could argue, until the 1950s. I mean, that's how dramatic an event it was. So the entire hinterland of what they called middle Florida.
One of Florida's many great migration, kind of, it's almost like a great migration sort of event.
Yeah, so the middle Florida, which is the Tallahassee area, for lack of a better term, is depopulated completely. And colonists retreat to Pensacola and St. Augustine. There are only two towns left in the state. And everything else is depopulated, and you have Native Americans who are wiped out, right? And the Native population is minuscule from that point until the Creeks begin, the Creek Seminole thing happens, which then becomes, and as we get later in this work and into the subsequent works, the Seminoles become key allies of the British from the time of the American Revolution until the Americans take over Florida. In fact, even the Second Spanish period, it is the British who are arming the Seminoles, realizing they're useful allies against their common enemy, which are the Americans, the newly founded United States.
If you're enjoying the show, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/tropicaldepression. Also, please consider leaving us a positive review or subscribing at Spotify, our Apple podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us bring more good quality Florida content straight to your ears. I appreciate everyone, and thanks a lot for listening.
So I think you've even said other places that Florida is maybe one of the few places where you had free black Americans that were armed, right? And this was a strategic formation. This was a strategic formation throughout Florida's early history, was it not?
Yeah, this is the key. This is probably the takeaway about this entire thing, and maybe why guys like DeSantis don't want us to learn this history. So 1739, we have the beginning of the War of Jenkins' Ear, which is a colonial conflict loosely connected to the War of Austrian Succession in Europe. And Spain's on one side and Britain's on the other. Georgia by this time has been founded, which causes more problems for Spanish Florida. And James Oglethorpe, very famous, right? The founder of Georgia. He leads and Oglethorpe himself, actually, ironically enough, was anti-slavery. But once he was dead and gone, Georgia became a slave, just as bad a slave state, as slave colony as any other. But Oglethorpe invades Florida on behalf of the British. And you have free blacks, the runaway slave efforts have really intensified after Queen Anne's War. I should mention that from 1713, from that peace treaty, Treaty of Utrecht, until 1739, when the Stono Rebellion took place in South Carolina, you have a steady drift of runaway slaves coming to Florida. Then in 1739, Stono Rebellion in South Carolina, those rebels were trying to make their way to Florida. Some of them made it. So Spanish wisely realize, and I owe our mutual friend Steve Shale credit for this. Steve told me years ago, you need to look into a place called Fort Mose, because Steve, of course, is from St. Augustine. I know we associate him with Tallahassee these days, but he's from St. Augustine originally.
Yeah, Northeast Florida, like, Duval.
Yeah. He's from that part of the state, the First Coast. Steve says you have to look into this place, Fort Mose. So I do it. And I'm thinking, you know, it's just another fort or like another historical ruin in the first coast of Florida, St. Augustine area. And in fact, it's got this unbelievable history. That is where the Spanish allowed free African-Americans who had converted. Again, they had converted to Catholicism. They didn't convert to Catholicism. They didn't get their freedom. To have their own town, their own village that they managed, they governed, and they were armed. And they were the front line against the British invasion. And they were able to hold the line. They were able to actually defeat the British after the British had occupied the town, Fort Mosse. And they were key defenders of St. Augustine when the city was being sieged by the British, who came by sea in that case. And they had the other force that had come by land that they had battled at Fort Mosse. And they were able to protect St. Augustine in that siege. And a lot of it was armed, freed blacks, African Americans taking up arms, which was horrifying. Think about it. If you're a Southern planter and you're from Carolina or Georgia, your biggest fear is armed blacks. And so the Spanish took advantage of that in Florida. And whatever other notions of race the Spanish had, which they had some, they did not have this hang-up that the British had, which, by the way, the British are going to get over. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. They didn't have this notion of not arming blacks and natives. They armed Native Americans. And of course, the British were willing to do that as well. Another thing I should point out, which I don't get into in the book, because it's not a book about the Spanish, but the Spanish had a very different kind of legal code when it came to slaves. Slaves had more legal rights in the Spanish Empire than they did in the British Empire at this point in time, when we're talking about the 1730s and 1740s.
So with this, you might even say, maybe I'm off base here, but you have people even drawn, you know, in a Caribbean, in a trans kind of Southeastern Caribbean Monroe Doctrine area point of view, this almost kind of like maybe anticipates the Haitian Revolution in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that is a great analogy, because you have the Haitian Revolution begin in the 1790s in kind of a similar fashion. And I think you have a planter class, and that's going to contribute to a lot of what happens in Florida after, because and we'll get into that in the third volume of what I'm working on, which is going to cover that period. The Spanish are continuing to allow, and actually in that case, they're not really encouraging it, but the Seminoles are around then, and they're what we call the Black Seminoles, which were runaway slaves. Mm-hmm. And the British, seeing the terror that the French faced in Haiti, the French planters think, you know, if we arm these Seminoles and they're these runaway slaves, we can strike the same terror into the Americans. Because one thing that we have to understand about the British is that they're very pragmatic. They have their notions of race. But once the American colonies rebel, they are the enemy. And to them, all of a sudden, blacks and Native Americans are potential allies against the common enemy. And the British leverage that, and they leverage that here in Florida in particular during the Revolutionary War.
No question. So take us a little bit further down this timeline from where we are. You know, what happens next?
So 1763, Florida, the Floridas do become part of the British Empire after the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, as we call it in North America. The British from 1763 to the early 1770s begin to organize Florida, just like Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia. There's plantations that are set up. Slavery is brought wholesale into the colony. Those freed African Americans that defended St. Augustine, that had converted to Catholicism, they all moved to Cuba or some other Spanish colony, Cuba, Mexico, mostly Cuba, because the climate was similar. They go to Havana and other places. And you have the Floridas now, as it's called. The colony is split into East and West Florida. West Florida is governed from Pensacola. It includes all the way to the Mississippi River. So Baton Rouge, Mobile, Natchez, those were other settlements that were in the colony of West Florida at the time. The British settle it just like they settled the rest of the southern colonies. There's slavery. There are plantations. There is really kind of brutal treatment of African Americans. The economy is made similar to those places. Although by the early by 1767, and then especially in the early 1770s, there was a realization Florida is more like the West Indies from a climate standpoint. So the British, who have big plans for the colony, begin importing people from Minorca, which is in the Mediterranean, from you have your first Greek Orthodox community in what is now the United States that pops up in St. Augustine because they can adapt to the climate more. New Smyrna is founded, very much named for Smyrna because colonists came from there, in addition to the fact that there were some historic ties between the family that founded it and the Ottoman Empire. And then you have even some Italians coming to Florida at that period. So again, St. Augustine is different than the other colonial capitals in that, yes, you have an Anglican hierarchy that's moved in. You have the British governing it, but then you have a lot of Catholics, and then you have a different relationship with Native Americans, right? So there's some Native Americans that are on the periphery of the town. There is slavery. Slavery is brought back. Slavery never went away. I should make that clear. Slavery never went away in Spanish Florida, but there were a fair number of free blacks. That's gone. And then the American Revolution starts and all bets are off. And in fact, rather quickly, the British, some officials more aggressively than others, and that's something we'll get into in the next volume of this work, pivot to a realization that they want to encourage runaway slaves from the Carolinas, Virginia, and Georgia to defect behind British lines and come to Florida and help the British war machine in St. Augustine, because East Florida has stayed loyal to the crown, unlike the colonies to the north. And there is a realization also among British officials, we need to arm the Native Americans, we need to arm the blacks, and nothing terrorizes these colonists, who by this time they felt were rabble and ungrateful, and really, you know, what this kind of notion has kept stayed with the British upper classes since, that Americans are uncouth, right? You know, like these. And I talk about in the book the growth of the Carolina backcountry, the kind of rough-hewn mountain culture that we associate with the Appalachians. That began to really turn the British authorities against the colonists, to the point where even before the Revolution, some of them were saying privately to one another, you know, we kind of prefer the Native Americans to these uncouth, uncivilized colonists, ungrateful colonists, because at least they still had their notions of racism. At least the Native Americans, they're obedient, right? When we train them, we bring them to our society, they're obedient, and they can be loyal, whereas these colonists are disloyal. So we'll leave it at this. In 1775 and 1776, the British in Florida, and they have loyalists that have defected from the other southern colonies too, white loyalists, are actively preparing African Americans and Native Americans to fight the American colonists and to raid southern Georgia. And to the British credit, they did a lot to win the trust, particularly Native Americans, because at this point, as I said, even as we approach the war, they're thinking maybe the Seminoles are preferable, in this case, the Seminoles, the Creeks if you're in Georgia, the Cherokees if you're in Georgia and the Carolinas, they're preferable to the white colonists, the rabble, as they called them. And so they're arming the Seminoles and encouraging them to raid into South Georgia and loot and kill as many patriots, as they were called, right? People who were on the American side of this war, the Continental Army side of this war, as possible. So that's where I leave off in this volume. And then the next volume, which I'm working on now, which should be out before the end of the year, which will coincide with Governor DeSantis' campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire, where he'll be telling more myths about American history, no doubt. We'll talk about why Florida stayed loyal to the British in the war, and the impact that African Americans and Native Americans made, in addition to loyalists, and how Florida stayed in British hands throughout the Revolutionary War, and how the likes of Sam Adams and John Hancock were hung in effigy and burnt in St. Augustine.
That's really interesting history, and I had no idea. Of course, that revolutionary history comes after something that I don't think is well understood enough these days. You know, we talk about the erasure of history under the DeSantis administration, and I think that there's generally, you know, the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, yeah, really you can't get from where we were to where we are today without the French and Indian War, even though Florida was largely unaffected by the conflict directly, and there was very little fighting here.
Yeah.
Florida was an important element of the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War. Tell us a little bit about that history as we kind of, as that kind of fades into the Patriots' Revolution against the British Crown.
Yeah, so obviously Florida had been a central front in Queen Anne's War from 1702 to 1713, and then in the War of Jenkins' Ear between 1739 and 1742. Because the French and Indian War is a conflict between the French and the British, more or less, there is no fighting in Florida. Spain, because of European considerations, takes the side. And the French and Indian War, by the way, or the Seven Years' War, is the first world war in reality. As someone of Indian descent, I can tell you that was the moment, the tipping point in which India became British colonization, British conquest of India became inevitable. Was that war? Yeah. A lot of the native states had aligned with the French, and
as usual, Florida involved at the very, very earliest stages of major international affairs.
Yeah, it's really the First World War. I would say that was actually World War One. World War Two was probably the Napoleonic War, and World War Three was the Crimean War. So what we call World War One was really World War Four, and World War Two is World War Five. But Florida changes hands because the British capture Havana after Spain takes the side of France in the war. And the British say, okay, we don't want Cuba, we don't want Havana, but let's trade Havana for Florida, which we think we want because it's connected to our southern colonies. And so they allow, they take Florida and they encourage white settlement in Florida as an alternative to what they did in the Appalachians, which we all know was a direct cause of the Revolutionary War, which was the British then said, okay, white settlers, you can't go there. That's set aside for the natives. And already, the war ends in 1763. Already in 1764, you see the British doing two things. One, they're trying to cultivate Native American allies, even though the Native Americans had largely fought on the French side in the war. Two, they're trying to placate Catholics, because they've absorbed Quebec and its French-Canadian population. And these two things end up becoming big factors in why Florida stays loyal to the crown after Florida becomes British. Because Florida then is settled, as I said, like the rest of the South for the first 6 or 7 years. Then more Catholics move in. I talked about the Minorcans and people from Italy. And you have Native Americans who become key allies of the British. The British are much more concerned about keeping the Creeks and the Seminoles on their side than these patriots. And that changes the composition of really how things go, because the British did not want white settlers in areas around the Appalachians and further west. And they, even after the United States wins independence in 1783, right, the British continued to arm the natives in those places. They don't abandon forts. They arm Native Americans. And here in Florida, and this will be something we get into in the next two volumes of this work, the Seminoles have a very strong, it's a tacit alliance, it's not a written alliance, but they have a very strong alliance with the British, to the point where when Andrew Jackson goes and pursues the Seminoles in Florida between 1814 and 1818, he's really going after the British. And there's a quote from that time where he talks about, until we conquer the Native Americans, we will never be safe from the British, because the British are the ones that are the hand behind the Native Americans. That was particularly true of the Seminoles.
So we know that Andrew Jackson, the first military governor of Florida, following is, I know this is after the purview of this current volume, but thinking about how they all spill, how the stuff all washes into today, how would you say that the relationship between the Seminole Indians and the British factors into Jackson and Americans' infamous thirst for the blood of Seminole Indians?
Yeah, it's absolutely the leading cause. In fact, Jackson, as I said, had this quote. I don't have it in front of me, but he said something along the lines of, with reference to Florida, that we have to go and wipe out the natives, because without that, we'll have the hand of the British right, you know, that can stab us in the back. And also he implied in the quote that the British were encouraging slaves to run away, which they were. And we're only about a decade at this point away from the British actually outlawing slavery in the British Empire, which is a whole nother story why so many runaway slaves then came to Florida even after that, because they could get to the Bahamas from Florida. Bahamas were a British territory until the 1970s. And so slavery was gone in the Bahamas from the 1830s onward. But yes, this is an important thing to understand, is that the Native Americans become a proxy for the British to destabilize the United States to the north. And the United States and Britain are at constant loggerheads until really the 1890s. Now, there was no war after the War of 1812, although I would argue Jackson's invasion of Florida is an adjacent conflict to the War of 1812, as is something called the Patriots War that happened in North Florida, Northeast Florida. Fernandina, Amelia Island were on the front edge, what is now Nassau County, front end of that Patriots War conflict, was an adjacent conflict where you had Americans, I believe, that were sanctioned by President Madison and Secretary of State Monroe to invade Florida, which was a Spanish territory at the time, but Spain was aligned with Britain, and the British were, in fact, more involved in Florida than the Spanish had allowed kind of an anarchy to develop in the second Spanish period, and the British had more influence with the Native Americans than the Spanish did. So the Seminole raids into southern Georgia, the Creek raids, and then the runaway slaves being brought to Florida, that was all being encouraged by the British up until Andrew Jackson successfully burns down the fort on the Apalachicola River, famously, in 1818.
In many ways, taking out his wrath on perpetuating the cycle of violence, right? In many ways, yeah. One colonial power to another.
Yeah, and it's also really kind of ironic, because throughout most of the volume, and this is the book right here for those who are watching the video.
Yes.
Perpetually, the British are the bad guys, and the British are the racists, and the British are a really very aggressive in trying to pacify the Native Americans. The second colonial problems begin to creep up, and that's not even when war begins in 1775. That's 1765, right, when the American colonists begin to complain about the Stamp Act and all of the other intolerable acts. Suddenly, the British, being the pragmatic divide-and-conquer rulers that they are, and I know this really well from Indian history, from my knowledge of Indian history, the British are all about divide-and-conquer. And they, at that point, suddenly the natives are their allies, and they see as more benign and more worthy than the colonists. So they effectively flip sides based on their own considerations. And as I said, up until Andrew Jackson comes in and wipes out the Seminole settlements and forces the Seminoles further south into the peninsula, the British are arming him. The British are encouraging them. The British are doing whatever they need to do to prop up the Seminole nation, I think justifiably, that's my own personal opinion, to fight this menace of American colonial expansion, of the new United States trying to subjugate lands and create a manifest destiny. So the British are very much kind of on the right side of that, if you look at that as the right side of history, after having been on the wrong side for 200 years.
Yeah, Florida, as ever, with an ever-shifting the people who live here, people of color, the subaltern, people who are on the wrong side or on the other side of the power, the big power and accumulations of wealth in Florida's history. That conflict, that eternal conflict, flows through history. We see time and time again, and it never ceases to be interesting. We'll see another iteration of it later on. When you're talking about Reconstruction era in Florida, which, you know, many people would argue that the project of Reconstruction never properly took root. It was never certainly completed in general, but maybe most keenly here in Florida, right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe we could say it was completed in the Askew years, 100 years later, and now we're backsliding, right? So this is 2023 Florida isn't that much different from a cultural political attitude among those running the legislature than 1923 Florida, which is, of course, when Rosewood happened.
And I do think that. I think that's exactly right. I don't think these connections are trivial at all. I really do think you see the atavistic conflicts of the same forces over time, regardless of what the actual formal relationships and boundaries are, right?
Yeah, and I think some of us, yourself and myself included, have to accept we are now 50 years on from the Golden Age. We are now 50 years on from the Askew, the time when Reuben Askew made Florida the shining city on the hill, the state to be envied, the state that California and New York were jealous of. We were more progressive than California in the 1970s in terms of the laws we passed, the way we managed our state, the way we managed our resources, the way we put in place growth management, and we had accountability in government. Florida was the envy of the country. 50 years later, it's the butt of jokes. And that means, just like from Reconstruction to the era when Florida led the nation in per capita lynchings, we came full circle, right? Florida was the most, in terms of per capita, the most racist state when it comes to lynchings from 1887 to 1950. Similarly, we were the shining city on the hill in the 1970s and Bob Graham's era of the 1980s. And we've slouched towards this place where we're unrecognizable, quite frankly, for people like you and I who are steeped in the history and culture of this state.
Yeah, you're so right. What else, as we begin to wrap up, what else stays with you from this period? What do you think goes underexplored, and what kind of lessons do you take from this volume and to analyzing today's contemporary history? And I want to say again, congratulations on the publication here, and we'll include in the show notes how folks can get this important book.
Great, yeah, thank you for that. I think the most important thing to understand is that Florida was different. It developed differently. We had a multicultural heritage during the 1600s. St. Augustine was a place where you would see artisans and traders and merchants from Italy, from Spain, obviously, from Portugal, from different places, from the West Indies. You would see people mixing. It was very, very different. And we were the first place in the country where African Americans were armed and allowed to be armed and take up arms against white aggressors or against their oppressors, so to speak. Because in a lot of cases, what I should have mentioned about the War of Jenkins here is a lot of those runaway slaves were people who were then armed against their former masters, right? The slaveholders, because they were the ones invading Florida, right? From the Carolinas and Georgia. And that Florida fought on the British side of the Revolutionary War for significant reasons that make us question the myths that we've been taught throughout the years that there was a good side and a bad side of the American Revolution. And the founding fathers and the patriots were these heroic, plucky underdogs fighting for the common man. And the British were these awful, nasty elitists. Now, it's true, if you look at the white population, economics often tended to determine what side you were on, right? I mean, the economic elites very much, other than the planters, right? The planter class in the South were patriots, but the economic elites and the merchants and the Tory class, they tended to be fighting on the side of the British. But there is a reason why, and I was just listening to the Empire podcast, which is a podcast done by William Dalrymple and Anita Anand out of the UK. They had an American historian on to talk about the Revolutionary War. And she said, we have to come to grips, and this was for 4th of July, with the fact that the vast majority of Black people who took up arms in the American Revolution fought on the British side. And the vast majority of Native Americans that took up arms in the American Revolution fought on the British side. And I would add to that, the vast majority of Catholics that took up arms fought on the British side. When the Americans invaded Quebec, thinking that these French Canadians wanted to be liberated, they didn't want to be conquered by the colonists. And then the same thing happened in the War of 1812, right? They fought valiantly on the British side, the French Canadians. So these are things we have to grapple with as Americans, as Floridians, and as Americans. And this is the sort of thing, again, maybe just to close on this note, that the governor of this state, who wants to be the president of the United States, will not talk about, will not accept, and does not want as part of the historical discussion, which is why he has been, among other reasons, so aggressive in trying to curtail what we can learn and what we can discuss with school children about history and about this state and this country.
I have no question, no doubt at all that from as a practical matter, understanding, grappling with, interrogating this history and critically examining our history is absolutely an important part of liberation for all of us and a stronger Florida in the future. So thanks a lot for handling, for looking deeply into this stuff and for taking some time to teach us about it today, Kartik.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Looking forward to your next iterations of these great Florida history books. Again, folks, we'll have this in the show notes, but the book is Florida and the British, Prior to the American Revolution. Our guest is author Kartik Krishnire, publisher of the Florida Squeeze and so much else. Thanks for everything you do, and look forward to talking to you again about Florida history again soon, man.
Great. Thank you much, Ryan.